This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA at 90.7 KPFK, talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Later in this hour, what the Democrats need now is a leader who can bridge the gap between the white working class and people of color, between white men and everybody else, between rich and poor, somebody like Bobby Kennedy was in 1968. We'll speak with Larry Tye about Bobby and the hopes he raised in the 1968 presidential campaign. We'll also talk about the bad Bobby that came before the good Bobby. Larry Tye's book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, is out now in paperback. And for a break from Donald Trump, we'll talk about Bob Dylan. He gave his Nobel Prize speech last week. Some people have a few questions about that speech. Jonathan Lethem will comment. He edited a new collection called Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock. Trump Watch starts right now. Seems like every day these days is a bad news day for Donald Trump. For comment, we turn to Rick Perlstein. Of course, he's the author of a series of award-winning books on American politics, including the classic Nixon Land and most recently, The Invisible Bridge. Rick Perlstein, welcome back.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Pretty good. Well, big picture here. The question is, what does Putin want from Trump? What does Trump want from Putin? Something tells me neither one of them is acting out of pure friendship. The first part was Putin helps make Trump president. Now it's Trump's turn. And what we think Putin wants, first of all, is an end to American sanctions. But Republicans in the Senate didn't seem to get Trump's memo on this. The news today is that the Senate overwhelmingly approved a package of new Russia sanctions that also lets Congress block Trump from easing or ending penalties against Moscow. The vote was 98-2. Rick, what are the Senate Republicans telling Trump here?
It sounds like the president is being put on notice by at least a portion of his own party, right? I mean, we'll go with you this far, but no further. It's a pretty striking indication that they're not going to go down with him. They seem to be politically isolating him. Doesn't it seem that way to you?
Yeah. I mean, these are guys who, have not taken a stand against Trump before, but this is
right. Is
pretty decisive. And
this might be newsworthy. We might be remembering this a while from now.
Yeah.
And it's very striking because it's been pointed out. The American Prospect, it might have been Harold Meyerson, your fellow Angelino, who said that Congress, basically with impeachment as a serious proposition around the corner, really has Donald Trump in their pocket, that he has to do their bidding if he doesn't want them to vote against him to kick him out of office. So this might be the opening salvo and people saying, look, you don't have our loyalty. It is conditional. We are willing to negotiate with you, but we are not willing to surrender to you.
Well, that was today's bad news for Trump. Yesterday was a really bad news day for Donald Trump. The Washington Post yesterday had that huge scoop that special counsel Robert Mueller is investigating Trump for obstruction of justice.
Oh, John, haven't you read the talking points?
Tell me.
The Republican talking points.
Tell me.
His investigation of Donald Trump's collusion with Russia having crashed and burned, he's desperately reaching out for this new gambit.
The greatest witch
hunt in history.
What is a talking points memo? Publish the talking points. It would be very appropriate for talking points
the
memo.
The talking points leaked, my friend. and when Republicans, leak an internal strategy document, that means that someone within that party, in addition to being willing to vote against Russia sanctions, is willing to turn the media on to something that will humiliate the president.
Well, I mean,
which might be the most powerful political indicator of all.
Yeah,
that's politics, red in tooth and claw, right there.
Yes, it is. Well, I was trying to think of when was there a good news day for Donald Trump. The last one I can remember was the day that the House finally succeeded in passing something to repeal and replace Obamacare. But then on Tuesday, Trump declared that that House bill to repeal and replace Obamacare was, quote, mean. So
No. John, you're getting it all like mean.
I mean, that was the last positive thing that Congress accomplished on his agenda, and now I think he is contradicting himself here.
I got to interrupt you again. Didn't you watch the cabinet meeting? He's making the greatest progress of his legislation of any president since FDR, and he had a depression.
Well, I can see you've been paying more attention than I have to this. There was a fascinating piece I want to get your reaction to in the New York Times yesterday about more leaks from the White House about what's going on there. I'm reading from the New York Times. There's a growing willingness among White House staff to try to keep Mr. Trump from making damaging mistakes. This is an important internal change in a White House dominated by a president who often demands obeisance. Among the aides most alarmed by the idea of firing Robert Mueller, the special counsel, remember this was sort of a trial balloon a couple of days ago. Trump might fire the special counsel, sort of shades of Watergate here. We might get into that. Among those most alarmed by this was Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff. Supporters for firing Comey included Jared Kushner. And then it says, Mr. Trump's wife, Melania, has adopted a more temperate tone, telling her husband she believed the appointment of Mr. Mueller would speed the resolution of the Russia scandal. She expressed her view that he would be exonerated.
That's mind-blowing. I've never heard her name pop up in one of these news articles before.
Exactly.
I mean, they're pulling out the big guns here. What is Melania's position in this?
Melania's position
is
that Donald should not be upset about Mueller because his work will speed the resolution of the Russia scandal and exonerate the president. That's Melania's view.
So someone, perhaps Melania, is leaking internal White House deliberations involving Melania. Well, Melania Trump is kind of like she's kind of team realist, you know, as opposed to kind of team, you know, batten down the hatches, you know, throw boiling oil over the side of the castle. Wow.
What can you say?
I don't know what to think. I guess this has to do with her moving to Washington and she's getting into the game.
Oh man! So whose views of the president threatening to fire Mueller, who's not quoted on this, is Ivanka. We know nothing about Ivanka. We have air silence from Ivanka on this. We know what Melania thinks. We know what Jared thinks. So that's just where we stand today.
Is there daylight between Jared and Ivanka? Has that ever happened?
Probably not.
I'd be
very surprised. So, Rick Perlstein, the trial balloon about the president firing the special counsel investigating him. This must have reminded you of some events back in Nixon land.
Yeah. Well, this is, of course, we're talking about the firing of Archibald Cox.
Yeah.
And the trial balloon that Nixon floated then was this is really getting deep in the weeds. The Stennis Compromise, where, you know, this is all about whether he would have to release the tapes or transcripts of tapes once people knew that there were tapes and they'd been subpoenaed. And he said, well, I have a great compromise that everyone will agree with. That's we can have this very distinguished senator, John Stennis, listen to them himself because he's a person of unimpeachable probity and transcribe them and describe their contents, and that will kind of protect the executive privilege and all that stuff.
I have to ask, you said he had unimpeachable probity.
Unimpeachable.
Unimpeachable probity. Did he have unimpeachable hearing?
No, his hearing was 25th Amendment worthy. He couldn't hear. And he was also a very sympathetic figure because he'd just been mugged in Washington. So that one, you know, kind of fell flat. And, you know, his next move was firing the special counsel. And the reason that set such a constitutional crisis in motion wasn't only that he fired the guy who was investigating him, but that very early, very cleverly, and something you'd like to see Democrats in the Senate do now, Democrats had forced a marker to get Elliot Richardson nominated as Attorney General. They made him promise not to be a party to getting in the way of a special prosecutor investigation. So he refused to do that, and they kind of knocked it down the line. And then finally, you know, assistant Attorney General Robert Bork did it. But we saw something in that regard today. The deputy attorney general said he wouldn't fire Mueller unless it was for cause. So it does seem to be that people are kind of laying down their markers that they're not going to be complicit. You know, in the same way the 98 senators said they wouldn't be complicit with that kind of hands arm's length collusion with Russia, that they were going to support sanctions. So, yes, all these sort of firewalls against Donald Trump's decline seem to be crumbling. So big, beautiful firewalls.
We've reviewed the bad news days of the last 2 days. Then there was Tuesday. That was when our Attorney General Jeff Sessions testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee. First of all, I need to ask you, is it unfair to call Jeff Sessions a little weasel?
He's little, and let's just deal with the evidence on the table because we are historians.
Yes.
He obviously lied about several things. He obviously perjured himself before the Senate when it came to saying that his participation in the firing of Comey, had nothing to do with the Russian investigation. It was only because the FBI was in disarray. The timeline just absolutely makes no sense. He claimed, he considered himself recused from the get-go, but recusal involves very specific official acts that he didn't take. Now we know that he has invited to a dinner a lobbyist very well known in Washington for handling Russia's business, including Gazprom and the bank that does a lot of this stuff. And that this is a lobbyist named Burt, I believe, his last name, B-U-R-T, and that this is the same guy who helped Trump's famous foreign policy speech that he delivered at the Mayflower Hotel, which he delivered and then kind of went into a private meeting with a lot of these people involving allegedly the acts of collusion. So he is weaseling all the way down, so it would appear to me at this juncture, at this point in time, as they used to say during Watergate. Do you agree?
I have to agree. And I, you know, when Jeff Sessions, so many times he said, I don't remember, I don't recall, it reminded me of that spot on the Nixon White House tapes. He's rehearsing on how to stonewall, I think it's before the grand jury. And he says,
yeah.
You can say I don't remember, you can say I don't recall, I can't give any answer to that I can recall.
That's good. I should go on YouTube and find that one. Sounded exactly like that. And of course, but the Nixon administration, you know, this is a really good example of how much more competent they were in the Trump administration. Nixon really was orchestrating a strategy for how they would do this, but Trump has not, and that's why Sessions' answers to why he couldn't answer were incoherent and ended up contradicting each other. And that was, of course, brought home very strikingly and forcefully by your new senator, Kamala Harris,
yes.
Who painted him in a corner, and he said, you know, basically stop asking questions so fast, you're making me nervous. And then, you know, John McCain rescued him from the little lady by saying, you know, basically let him answer.
Memorable.
That was meme worthy.
That was memorable. And we are told another leak is is that I'm quoting again from the New York Times, while the president is deeply suspicious of Robert Mueller, his anger is reserved for Mr. Sessions for recusing himself from the Russian inquiry. That's also an amazing leak to have.
Haven't we known that for 3 days now? We've known that forever.
I think so. I think you're right.
I mean,
old news.
Yeah. Although that also contradicts Mr. Sessions, because, yes, as we know, Mr. Sessions considered himself recused de facto from the minute he was sworn in.
Yeah.
So once more, these two things cannot both be true at the same time.
I understand that we have an anniversary of the Watergate coming up. What is it and when is it?
This would be the burglary on June 17th. And I say the burglary, everyone talks about the burglary as if there was only one burglary. Of course, as you know, there were several burglaries. The burglary that the burglars were caught for in the Watergate on at Democratic headquarters on June 17th was an operation to fix a bug that they had installed incorrectly. So this was their second go-round, and they were caught. And that during the same night as the first break-in, they were basically casing the McGovern campaign for a burglary. And there was also, some people think, a burglary. Well, there was a burglary in one of Humphrey's biggest associates, Max Kempelman, who also was in the Watergate, that has never been kind of definitively tied to Watergate. But there were lots of burglaries, but the one that was important was the one they were caught, and that was June 17th, 1972, the famous fourth-rate burglary that was heard around the world.
To remind us of the way they got caught.
So they had taped a lock shut in the garage, parking garage, and, you know, kind of taped over the clasp, and they did it, if they had used the tape vertically, the tape wouldn't have been visible. They did it horizontally, and the security guard said, "Why is there a piece of tape on the door? I'm supposed to guard." His name was Frank Willis. He became a national hero because he proved that no one is beyond the law, and that a minimum wage security guard could, you know, bring down a president. And he called the police, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. The day after tomorrow, June 17th, 1972. And so remind us, how long was it from the burglary to the resignation?
Oh, that was 2 years and 2 months.
2 years and
2 months. 2 years and 1.5 months, yeah.
So
these things took a while back then.
Yeah, Trump were now...
Because Nixon was a smart criminal, and he actually knew how to stonewall. But Trump can't keep his lies straight, so I think we're on a faster timetable.
Well, everything is moving faster these days. So Trump, we're about, what, day 110 or something like that. We're a long way from 2 years. But still, it does suggest we're at the beginning of this. We're not. It doesn't seem like we're at the end of this. We're at the beginning
of this. You know, you should tell the Republicans that, because every time, you know, Donald Trump is not kind of discovered, you know, kind of on tape, you know, in passionate embrace with Vladimir Putin, they tell us, well, nothing's been found. There's no smoking gun. They don't understand that our investigation is a process, and that when each new day in the investigation reveals new, more evidence, never less or never exculpating evidence, maybe you should, you know, stop. Well, maybe they have stopped with the Senate vote. Who knows?
Every day seems like a bad news day for Donald Trump. Rick Perlstein in Chicago. Rick, it's always great to have you on the show.
Cheers.
Thanks very much. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK with Trump Watch and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, Bob Dylan, Achilles, and Spark Notes. Jonathan Lethem will comment. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org, and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Later in this hour, the good Bobby Kennedy and the bad Bobby. But first, let's take a break from Donald Trump and talk about Bob Dylan, who gave his Nobel Prize speech earlier this month. For comment, we turn to Jonathan Lethem. He writes wonderful novels. We talked about Dissident Gardens here a while ago. He's written, I think, 7 others. He's also the co-editor of a terrific new collection. It's called Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop. And he also teaches at Pomona College. Jonathan Lethem, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, you are a Bob Dylan scholar. You did the Rolling Stone interview with Bob Dylan about modern times. That was in 2006, a fantastic piece of writing. What was it like talking in 2006 to the future winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature?
Well, you know, he'd recently published his memoir, Chronicles Part One, and so we talked about book writing quite a bit. We didn't speculate on his chances for the Nobel, but he was fresh off. I think he was doing a lot of comparing that experience to what it was like to put a record out, and he really felt that the literary critics had treated him well, and he'd been into that, and so that was one of the sidelines. But I'd been a fan for a long, long time. I'd sort of grown up into my Dylan listening, my Dylanology, because my parents had his records around, and so it was pretty amazing to be actually seated across from him and getting to, you know, bounce my own theories off the man himself.
And of course, Chronicles Volume 1 is one of the greatest things he ever did, in my opinion.
It's a beautiful book, yeah, and a very strange one. Not, you know, it's not orderly, and it's not obedient to the idea of what a great figure's autobiography ought to be. I mean, certainly for someone who seems so definitively a man of the 60s, he sort of works around the edges, actually. That time.
Yeah, and his persona is so different in the book from what we learn from things like the Rolling Stone interviews.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the insights I had sort of halfway through our conversation was, oh, he's not a Dylanologist. He's Dylan. He doesn't think of these things the way someone else would, and he's also not, you know, accumulating, I ended up making reference to moments in his musical career. Like, there was a song he'd played one time only on David Letterman, a cover of a blues song called Don't Start Me Talkin'. And I introduced this to him because I thought it was sort of amusing, and it was a kind of a singular moment, and he was just completely confused. He had no idea he'd played the song. I mean, he said that in so many words. He said to me, I played that? And I said, yeah, you can go on YouTube and confirm this. It really did happen. But, you know, he's not studying himself. He's just living his life.
So I know our listeners will want us to address the news of the day, or at least the news of yesterday, that Bob Dylan plagiarized part of his Nobel Prize speech. The speech is about three books he read as a young person that influenced him deeply for the rest of his life. Moby Dick is one of them. He says in his Nobel Prize speech, the ship's crew is made up of men of different races, and guess what? Somebody at whatever it was, one of his many follower critics said, there are spark notes that contain the sentence, a crew made up of men from many different countries and races, appears in the spark notes. So Bob Dylan said, the ship's crew is made up of men of different races, about Moby Dick. The spark notes say, it's a crew made up of men of many different countries and races. Is this plagiarism? My view is, I don't care much about that. My view of Bob is, you know, bow down to him on Sunday, salute him when his birthday comes. But what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm glad you put it in a kind of in air quotes, the breaking news, because, I mean, you know, if you care about Dylan at all, it's sort of comical. This just in, Bob Dylan is a pastiche. He's a patchwork artist. He loves to use his magpie, I think magpie genius, to cobble together texts, whether they're song lyrics or, you know, there's all sorts of evidence of borrowing in Chronicles, the book we were just both praising. And, I'm not sure if I really deserve the credit for this, but I'm going to claim the credit. I was watching an old film noir one day, and a character said, to live outside the law, you must eschew dishonesty. And I was like, ding. it's everywhere. And that's his method, right? So to suddenly be in a state of red alert, like we've just nabbed him, or that we've nabbed him for the first time using his method, which is to, he's a sponge. He picks up language and inspiration and snippets of melody and formal ideas from everywhere and everything. This has been true for decades now. But I think the spark notes thing, you know, it kind of goes in another box, which is his recent very cavalier or kind of passive-aggressive response to the whole Nobel Prize thing.
Yeah.
And so it strikes people in a slightly different way because it seems like he's, I mean, I saw somewhere online someone said he's trolling the Nobel Prize committee, you know, by coming in with this sort of, you know, half-assed approach to being a laureate. It's really like he kind of wants to make them feel like they're Mr. Jones and he's the one who's telling them that something's happening and they don't know what it is.
So what did you think of the Nobel lecture as a whole? A lot of people loved it.
Well, I think it was really evocative and scatterbrained at the same time. You know, it was like a lot of his public addresses when he does get into this situation. He you know, I mean, or also some of his major interviews where he's been allowed to rewrite them and work on the language himself, you know, going all the way back to the Nat Hentoff one where he made up all sorts of weird biographical fantasies about himself that were taken seriously. It seems like he doesn't want to sit still in these situations. And so, you know, there's really meaningful stuff, there's provocations, and there seems to be digressions all in the same space. But it's a kind of he's the ultimate mercurial public figure. He really doesn't want to get trapped in anyone's net. And so I think, you know, a lot of his diffidence or just weird behavior around the Nobel seems to have been generated by this desire not to suddenly be stuck on anyone's pedestal or defined on anyone else's terms.
Well, I'm one of these people who is probably a little bit too literal for Bob Dylan, but I was puzzled by the end of his Nobel speech. He's talking about the Odyssey and about Achilles at the end of the Trojan War. He comes home a hero, and Bob quotes Homer saying, if Achilles could, he would choose to go back and be a lowly slave to a tenant farmer on Earth rather than be a hero in the underworld. I just sort of scratched my head. What does this mean? Is Bob saying he would rather be a lowly slave than our hero, the winner of the Nobel Prize?
I think he's in the mixed up high and low, collision of these references. He certainly is, in a way, making one of his most organic gestures, which is to say, I'm the beggar, I'm the thief, I'm that, you know, guy on your stoop with a paper bag, with a drink in a paper bag. I'm not some exalted figure. You know, he really does seem to want to claim the kind of, you know, I mean, it used to be that he wanted to be thought of as a hobo riding the rails or there was a time, and I think when he famously refused the laurels of that were being offered him by saying, I'm just a song and dance man.
Yeah.
Who's going to throw this minstrel boy a coin? If you look at it in that index of Dylan utterances, it's very simple. He's just basically saying, put me with the unexalted ones, mm-hmm. please.
Mm-hmm. We are speaking with Jonathan Lethem, Bob Dylan scholar, Bob Dylan fan, and co-editor of a wonderful new collection called Shake It Up, Great American Writing and Rock on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. Let's talk about this new anthology from the Library of America. Who would have thought the Library of America would do an anthology on writing about rock and roll? 600 pages long. The biggest single question to me when I opened this book was, which Greil Marcus piece are you going to include? Greil Marcus, the founder of rock criticism, a frequent guest here. I have to say I was puzzled by your solution to this dilemma.
You know, we circled around a lot of different possibilities. Greil is one of the only, you know, music writers who is already kind of firmly canonized. That's partly his own capacity for talking to, talking in different, registers at the same time.
Yeah.
He's great at reviewing a record that's just come out, but he also, from the very beginning, was insisting that this seemingly ephemeral kind of, cultural stuff, these records, these 45s, these rock and pop utterances from people like Elvis Presley that were often taken to be kind of, you know, just demotic, were actually speaking in the American grain, that they connected to, you know, to the search for a literary and a creative expressiveness that would rise to the occasion of this, you know, this strange experiment that we call American life. And so he's always put things in a very historicized and really a large context. When we ended up grabbing onto that very recent piece of his from it's still his most recent book. We were thrilled because it was him doing his biggest kind of work.
He was let's just explain. This is about somebody who is not a rock and roll musician. It's about somebody who's a video artist named Christian Marclay.
Yes. Well, everyone knows his name lately for doing The Clock.
Yes.
This is a piece that Christian Marclay did years earlier where he dragged a guitar behind a pickup truck and recorded the results and then released it as if it was a rock and roll song. It's like beyond feedback. It's the sound of an instrument being destroyed. So it's a kind of conceptual art gesture. But what Marcus does that's so marvelous is he connects it both to, you know, to things like Jimi Hendrix trying to make a guitar sound ways it never had before and ultimately, you know, setting one on fire, but also to an image of, you know, a tragic American image of the lynching, and that there's some kind of, you know, meaning nested inside of Christian Marclay's gesture of dragging this guitar behind a pickup truck that evokes very, very dark American legacies. And I just think it's a brilliant piece. But, you know, I feel that way about all the pieces in the book. We're really proud of what we were able to pull together into this this place with the help of the Library of America. And Kevin and I worked on this, you know, contents page for years before we were satisfied and you know, felt we'd represented this great story of, you know, people trying to write about music. It's not easily done.
Well, yeah, we're talking about the new anthology, Shake It Up. Mostly it's great writing about great music, about Dylan and Otis Redding, Elvis Presley, Prince, and so on. But one of my favorite pieces is about music that is not great. I'm so glad you included Chuck Klosterman on Fargo Rock City. Thank you for that.
That's a marvelous book. And, yeah, I mean, writing about music that you find inexplicable how anyone could devote themselves to it. There's also a terrific piece about, you know, going to a Barry Manilow concert.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd happily read that piece 100 times before I'd, you know, go and see a Barry Manilow show myself. But it's a marvelous, marvelous account. And, you know, we did figure that this was an anthology of writing. And the standard for us was, does the piece work? Does it hold up? Does it make us feel something? Does it make us think differently when we read it? You know, rather than a bunch of pieces about canonical figures in music history. There are plenty of accounts of the story of rock and roll. You know, this is a story of rock writing.
Let's talk for a minute about the late, great Lester Bangs. One of the big challenges in this book is who are you going to pick on Elvis, since you could, there are many whole anthologies about Elvis. You picked Lester Bangs, his unforgettable piece, Where Were You When Elvis Died? For people who don't know who Lester Bangs was, tell us.
Right. Well, so Bangs was not one of that very first generation with, you know, you mentioned Greil Marcus and Paul Williams and a handful of other people,
Chris Gow, Ellen Willis,
who were kind of the founding writers. Lester Bangs comes along just shortly after that, early enough to be kind of grouped loosely with those kind of founding fathers and mothers. And he wrote a very energetic, chaotic, kind of freewheeling, provocative style. He was at his best sometimes in some very marginal publications. He wrote a lot for a magazine that people might not remember so much now called Cream.
Oh, yeah.
Spelled with two E's.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote, you know, before Chuck Klosterman came along, he was a defender of, you know, what might seem kind of like bubblegum or hair metal. You know, he would write about groups like Black Oak Arkansas or, you know, he famously wrote about the song Psychotic Reaction by the Count Five, basically saying it was every bit as good as, you know, the Yardbirds. He was a provocateur. He was a rock writing, you know, and he might be analogous to a figure like Hunter Thompson.
Yeah.
Part of the new journalism in the sense that he tested the limits of what could be done in a magazine format. And then he died young. He lived hard and didn't survive living hard. And so he became a bit of a kind of a legendary figure in that way that, you know, the those who flame out will become. And actually, you spoke of Greil Marcus before. Greil edited a collection of Lester Bangs writings that came out in the early 90s called Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, which was in a way a precursor to our own book. It was all Lester Bangs. It was just one writer, but it was the first gesture of sort of saying, hey, the writing around this music is something that you could put in hardcovers. It might be worth, you know, making a claim for it as something more than just magazine writing. It could stick around.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left here. Last question is, why do you think there's been so much great writing about rock and roll?
Well, you know, I mean, it arouses, you know, it's writing that's rising to an occasion. In my view, I'm kind of with Greil Marcus and other people who feel like American popular music, similar to, you know, Hollywood film and you know, and jazz and some other, you know, comic books are a, you know, enormous cultural register. At their best, they rise to the highest level of expressive arts and, you know, have an immediacy that is awe-inspiring. And so these writers are trying to, you know, meet this music where it lives. They're trying to do it justice.
Jonathan Lethem on hair metal, something we don't talk about that much at KPFK. Jonathan Lethem also writes about Bob Dylan. He did the Rolling Stone interview with Bob Dylan in a couple of years ago and published only recently more on Bob and his Nobel Prize. Jonathan Lethem is also co-editor of the terrific new anthology from the Library of America, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop. Thank you, Jonathan.
Great to talk to you.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, and this is Trump Watch. Hey, Trump Watchers, you can listen to Trump Watch anytime you want on TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, was there a bad Bobby before there was a good Bobby? We're talking about the Kennedys, of course. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening. Jerry Quickly with news and your calls about the news. But first, the making of a liberal icon, Bobby Kennedy. For that, we turn to Larry Tye. He's an award-winning journalist at the Boston Globe. He's the author of several bestsellers, and his book on Bobby Kennedy is out now in paperback. Larry Tye, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Well, at this political moment, it's hard not to wish for another Bobby Kennedy to lead the fight against you-know-who. Bobby Kennedy was shot 49 years ago this month here in L.A. at the Ambassador Hotel the night of the California primary. At that point, he was a leading fighter for social justice, for civil rights, for farm workers, seemed like the man most likely to end the war in Vietnam. But in the view of many historians, before there was this good Bobby, there had been a bad Bobby in the 50s and early 60s, the right-hand man to Joe McCarthy, militant Cold Warrior, devious, ruthless. And in the conventional view, the big question of Bobby's life is, why he changed. And the big answer, of course, is the assassination of his brother. I wonder what you think about the story of the bad Bobby and the good Bobby.
So I think the bad Bobby was already evolving into the good Bobby before his brother's assassination. And that was, if there was any single epiphany moment in his life, it was his brother's assassination. But from the day that he went to work for Joe McCarthy, the good Bobby was always there. It was just something that was the recessive gene. And the dominant gene, it looked like at the beginning, was the one who believed that Joe McCarthy was the only one in Washington who was standing up to the Soviet threat that he saw behind every pillar in the State Department. And I think that maybe the way to look at it is the bad Bobby was the son of Joe Kennedy, and he went to work for Joe McCarthy because Joe Kennedy believed in Joe McCarthy. He had his cold warrior outlook on the world because that was Joe Kennedy's outlook. But the more that Bobby saw the world and the more he experienced things at a grassroots level, like a parish priest might see things, the more he began to see that the world was a different place than the one his dad had presented him with, and the more he began to empathize with people who had black skin or who had no money or who had lots of things that growing up in Cape Cod and in Palm Beach, Florida, that Bobby Kennedy had never seen. So the evolution was a 20-year process. It was started out cold warrior, ended up liberal icon in between the death of his brother. But just living life is what changed Bobby in a way that gives me hope that politicians and maybe even people in the White House might someday be able to change.
Well, let's talk about Bobby Kennedy at the end. In 1968, the promise of Bobby Kennedy was that he would bring together white working class voters with blacks and Latinos, which, of course, is the task facing us today. And, of course, since 1968, we've seen a total transformation of the party system. Now a majority of white people always vote Republican, and a huge majority of blacks and Latinos always vote Democratic. In 1968, the divisions in America seemed insurmountable. How did Bobby propose to unite blacks and whites in 1968?
So what Bobby was on the cusp of doing, as you're suggesting, in 2017 terms, what Bobby was doing in 1968 was uniting Donald Trump's angry whites with Hillary Clinton's coalition of liberals and minorities.
Yes.
And he was able to do that because he had the credibility of having started out as Joe McCarthy cold warrior, and that developed him a following among whites, among Catholics, among more conservative voters, and those people continued, even as he was evolving politically and moving to the left, they continued to see him as somebody who did something that I think we never see today and that would be incredibly refreshing and is the way out of the wilderness for progressives. And that's the word authenticity, that Bobby Kennedy went into white communities and black communities and gave them both a message that they didn't want to hear. He told the black community that number one, before we can talk, riots just won't wash. He told the white community the only way we're going to get safe streets is by having racial justice. Both sides were so shocked at hearing a politician who came in and told them the truth and the difficult truth that they started listening to what he said in a very unusual way. And I think what would have happened, and nobody can ever prove me wrong, I think what was about to happen in 1968 was not just that Bobby Kennedy was about to win the Democratic nomination. The morning after his victory celebration at the old Ambassador Hotel in L.A., he was due to fly to Chicago, was due to be endorsed by Mayor Richard Daley, the most powerful big city mayor and Democratic stalwart in America. And I think that would have set off a wave of endorsements. And I think the ticket in 1968 would have been Bobby Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. That was a ticket that petrified Richard Nixon, because Nixon knew that 8 years before, Jack Kennedy had won in large measure because Bobby was his campaign manager. And when we think how close Humphrey came to beating Nixon, if Bobby had been the nominee with Humphrey on his ticket, without the riots in Chicago, I think that he would have ended up being the president. And had he been president in 1968, haystack to issues like racial divisions then, I think we might not be revisiting these kinds of issues with the kind of backlash, the kind of racial and other backlash that we see under Donald Trump is most reminiscent of anything of the kind of backlash we saw in 68 with Richard Nixon as the standard bearer of the Republicans. And while I don't want to make Bobby Kennedy out to be either a saint or a godsend, he was precisely the kind of tough liberal that many of us have been waiting 50 years to see reincarnated.
Well, let's stick with 1968 for another minute here, just to remind our listeners who may not remember this history too clearly. Lyndon Johnson withdrew from his own reelection campaign because of opposition within the Democratic Party to his war policy in Vietnam, and his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who had started out as a senator from Minnesota, formerly the mayor of Minneapolis, my hometown, was the heir apparent. Kennedy was not the first person to challenge Hubert Humphrey as the legitimate Democratic candidate. That was Eugene McCarthy. And many of us who were around at that time felt Kennedy was a little late, a little cowardly, a little reluctant to take up the Democratic cause. Remind us of that conflict within the left of the Democratic Party between the supporters of Gene McCarthy, who went on to win a majority of the Democratic delegates in the New Hampshire primary at a time when Bobby Kennedy had not yet declared. Remind us of that world.
Sure. That world was one precisely the way you've described it. It was Democrats looking for somebody, an anti-war candidate who was going to stand up to Lyndon Johnson, who just 4 years before had won by an almost historic margin.
Yes.
So they're looking for a candidate. Bobby Kennedy says no. Gene McCarthy jumps in. He goes to the New Hampshire primary, and in the snowy hills of New Hampshire, when you added up the Democratic votes and the Republican write-ins, Gene McCarthy, a senator nobody really knew from Minnesota, narrowly beats Lyndon Johnson, and upends the entire campaign. Exactly 4 days after that, Bobby Kennedy jumps in and says, "Me too." And all the early stigma that he had grown up with about him being a ruthless politician was reignited then. All the smart young college students went with Gene McCarthy, clean Gene McCarthy, not with Bobby Kennedy. And that was a great story. And it was a story reflected in the fact that the next day after Bobby jumped in, Murray Kempton, the famous columnist, sent a telegram to Ted Kennedy capturing the anger of the Democratic left. And the telegram said, "Your brother's entry into this race shows that St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland."
Wow.
And that was the kind of harsh judgment on Bobby Kennedy. And that judgment has stood for 50 years. Well, the truth is that there are enough people alive who know what I'm about to say that told it to me 50 years later that Bobby Kennedy had told a number of reporters and he had told a lot of close family and friends 9 days before New Hampshire that he was going to come in and jump into the race. But he felt like he owed it to Gene McCarthy, who had been running for months, to give him a clean shot in New Hampshire and that he would jump in after. So it was a ham-handed move. It was a dumb move politically, but it was exactly the opposite of ruthless. Only Bobby never lived that down. But by the end in L.A. that night when Bobby was gunned down, lots of Gene McCarthy's people had decided that Gene McCarthy may have looked good on the war, but he didn't look good on fighting poverty and on racial justice and lots of other issues. And Bobby Kennedy was a candidate who, especially in his victory that year in California, had proven himself. And it may just be they're inventing it, but 50 years later, one after another of the key people in McCarthy's campaign say that they were ready after California to jump ship for Bobby. Had he gone to this Chicago convention where there were riots in the streets, had Bobby gone there, the rioters in the streets are the kind of constituency Bobby generally drew on. And I think he had real potential to unite long-haired Gene McCarthy kinds of voters with the voters who became known as George Wallace or Donald Trump voters, and it would have been extraordinary.
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Larry Tye. He's written a terrific New York Times bestseller, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's out now in paperback. So let me just pursue this for one more minute. You think that the ticket would have been Kennedy at the top, Humphrey number two, and that they could have beaten Nixon? Play out that scenario for us.
Sure. The scenario is because what people did in those days, whether they liked one another or not, the top two people, the two strongest people in the party, like Jack Kennedy and the vice president that he hated, Lyndon Johnson, united. And they united because it made a stronger ticket for their party. And I think Hubert Humphrey, who had not entered any of the primaries, would have been overwhelmed at the point that the party stalwarts, like the powerful mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, when they were about to endorse Bobby Kennedy, that it would have been a stampede. The regulars were going to go with him. The people in the primaries had shown that they liked Bobby Kennedy better than they did Gene McCarthy. And I think that Humphrey and Kennedy actually had respect for one another. And I think they would have been a friendlier ticket than LBJ and JFK were. Had they jumped in together, and had you not had any dissension in Chicago, and had you had the candidate at the top of the ticket who understood better than anybody in America Richard Nixon's vulnerabilities, because he had run his brother Jack's campaign beating Nixon 8 years before, you add all of that up, and you say not just that Bobby might have won, but he might have won convincingly enough, and imagine the difference. I can't think of two people who had more contrasting visions for America, other than maybe Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, than Richard Nixon and Bobby Kennedy. And had he been the guy then, this is a guy who in 1968 was predicting that in 40 years we would have a black president. Mm. And everybody said, you're crazy. Mm. And this is the guy who gave us the model for Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty in the anti-poverty program as a senator that he launched in the biggest ghetto in America called Bedford-Stuyvesant. This is a guy who stood up in the U.S. Senate and said something there that nobody ever says in the U.S. Senate, which is, mea culpa, I was wrong on Vietnam. My brother and I got us into a war that was a mistake and we've got to get out. So on civil rights, he was the single most popular white man in black America. He was white on anti-poverty. He was white on race. And he had this extraordinary ability to draw in not just his natural constituency, but his 1950s constituency. Bobby Kennedy, the reason I wrote about Bobby Kennedy is that I thought his life was a perfect lens into how America was changing from the 50s to the 60s. And that change never really got a chance to play itself out because we ended up with Richard Nixon. Had we given Bobby Kennedy the White House, it would have been Barack Obama with the edge of a tough politician who knew how to get things done. And it's not accidental that for both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, their role model was not Jack Kennedy, it was Bobby Kennedy.
And the other side of the equation here is Richard Nixon. We think of Nixon as two-time president, gigantic landslide in 1972. But of course, Nixon in 1960 was kind of a loser. He'd lost not only the presidency in 1960, he'd also lost his run for governor. It wasn't clear that he was capable of being president. He hadn't been in the White House except as vice president.
So you're exactly right. And the only candidate that I think that he could have beaten was a guy like Hubert Humphrey, who he barely beat, but a guy like Hubert Humphrey, who was so badly wounded by having been LBJ's vice president, having been tarnished by an unpopular war, and having come off a convention where there were riots in the street. And in spite of all of that, and in spite of all of his weaknesses, Nixon almost managed to lose even to him. So had you had a united party behind a ticket like Kennedy Humphrey, or even a ticket like Humphrey Kennedy, the possibilities of victory and what that might have meant were extraordinary. And it was a chance to really take all of the good in LBJ's domestic war on poverty agenda and combine it with getting us out of Vietnam, not taking the years that Nixon took, but getting us out quickly the way that I think a Kennedy presidency would have done.
We've only got about 2 minutes left here. I just want to ask you about writing this book. This book is not just an argument about what might have been. It is a monumental work of research. Tell us a little bit about the work you did here.
So the work involved interviewing somewhere between 400 and 450 people, many of whom were in their 90s and were telling this story for the first time. It was traveling around the country, everywhere Bobby Kennedy had been or lived, and it was, most of all, an incredible labor of love. This was a guy who I grew up with as a hero, and it was seeing, on the one hand, his warts, and on the other hand, at the end of it, seeing him as a more flesh and blood and compelling hero, even than when I started out.
Larry Tye, his book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's out now in paperback. Larry, thanks for this book, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on. Good night.
Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guests. Rick Perlstein, he talked about how every day seems to be a bad news day for Donald Trump. We also spoke with Jonathan Lethem about Bob Dylan. Jonathan's new book is the wonderful anthology from the Library of America, Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. Thanks to our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. Thanks to our producer, Renee Reynolds. Thanks to Rye Cooter, as always, for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Stay tuned for Jerry Quickly coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK. This is happening, Jerry Quickly with the news and your calls about the news. Hey, Trump watchers, if you miss part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Trump Watch returns next week at this same time on this same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba ante mí.